on the board, and I'll be up on one of the whiteboards, and I'll be using this picture for other things as well. But in highly complex problems, there's a picture in one of the articles on Holograph, and we've seen sort of similar pictures. But let's think of a space, and just because I want to be able to picture it, I'm going to think of there being two features. It might be like, you know, heart rate and sweat production. We can think of those as two examples, but we'll probably have a dozen other features as well. And I'm going to put a bunch of O's here, up here. And each O is a point in the X and Y plane that has a particular heart rate and a particular sweat production rate. And then we got a bunch of X's. Okay, so the X's are liars. No, actually, that would be the wrong way, wouldn't it? The X's will be truth tellers, and the O's will be liars. That's my little legend. Now, notice I've got some X's mixed in among the O's. Okay, and if you look in that, and there might be some right on top of each other, in that particular article on polygraphs where they used the logistic model, you had a line that went like that. And that's the best line that you could, that's the best line that you can get that separates the X's from the O's. But you might be able to do better than that if you did something like this. If it wasn't, well, I still got an X on the O side, but you notice that I've done a better job of separating the X's and the O's with that nonlinear line. Now, of course, if whatever data set you give me, I mean, I stuck the X on the wrong side. I could swing the line around here, around that, and I could swing this line down around here. And so, basically, remember the problem of overfitting that I told you about. If you give me a particular data set, I can make a really squiggly line, and I can get all the O's on one side of the line and all the X's on the other side of the line. But, you know, give me another, well, if you put an O over here, I'll be fine. But you can also stick something on the wrong side of that line in your new data set, and I'm not going to necessarily get it. So you don't, what you want to do is you want to get a line that's good enough but not too good, if you will. And that's the challenge. But what in natural data sets, what will often happen is that this is really not a line. This is really a fractal surface. And some of the more recent methods in hierarchical Bayesian and wavelet analysis and other more sophisticated techniques are actually what they're actually doing mathematically is they're estimating some kind of a fractal curve here that is actually guesstimating something intrinsic in the data. And so you might actually be able to do a better job of discriminating by using some of these more sophisticated methods. But keep that picture in mind, and remember, and notice also that if I add additional features, I'll add something coming out here, I'll make it so that these will stand out from the page a little bit. And if they stand out from the page, and the O's are out here and the X's are back there, that gives us another dimension for classifying them, and it gives us another way to slice the curve in here. And every dimension that we add gives us more opportunities for separating them, but it also gives us more surfaces that we need to fit, because if we had three dimensions here, I'd need a two-dimensional surface to fit them, and that's more complex to estimate.
There's a couple of things that this does, too, that are worth noting if people haven't gone through this kind of lesson. Almost all of us can get these points over here correct, and almost any method will get them correct. And the same with these over here. And what Kathy was doing was changing the line in here in the middle where the methods really differ.
But these are the guys that are crucial to that false positive and false negative rate. Now let me take this picture and translate it to a different picture. Let's say, now what that is, it had this line, and the way it got this line was it took the features and it had a the line is W1 times feature 1 plus W2 times feature 2. And I put more features in here and more W's if I have more features. Okay? And that's what gives me this line. If you remember, this is the formula for a line. This is the X and this is the Y and this is the A and this is the B, if you remember from algebra class in high school. So basically, this is the, and if I change W's, I change the slope of the line. So what I'm going to do is my statistical procedure is going to estimate these W's. Now, once I've done this, this could be some other more complicated function. Okay, so this is linear. And nonlinear would be some function H of F1 and F2 given theta for you statisticians, and this theta is the parameter. And but either one of these, we'll call it a score. It gives us some kind of score. And we generally adjust it so that high scores are liars and low scores are truth tellers or the other way around. But we end up with a score. And the score tells us whether the score is not usually one or zero, it's a number, and we can scale it between 0 and 1 and turn it into a probability by some formula if we want to. But we have some score which measures truthfulness. Now, statisticians usually design their procedures so that if you have a large sample, the scores will be approximately normal and normally distributed. And there's a lot of statistical theory based on large sample sizes and normal distributions. And so let's just assume that we've done a good job as statisticians. And for truthful people, the scores tend to be normal. And for not truthful people, the scores tend to be normally distributed. But they have different normal distributions. So we might have a Gaussian curve here for the truth tellers. And we might have a Gaussian distribution here for the liars. And this is the distribution of scores for truth tellers and liars. Okay, and then down here, I'm going to do a different one. This is a different kind of test. Now remember how I got this from the previous page. I had things up here and things down here, and I had some kind of a score which was going to measure how. Actually, what the score does is it measures how far away from this line it is on from this surface it is on which side, and so that gets turned into this. And what happens is that the guys who are over here are the guys who were up here or down here. And the guys, so this is, you know, somebody over here is almost certainly lying. Okay, and in the terms of this picture, that would have been somebody that was up here in definitely in the lying region. And somebody who's down here is almost certainly telling the truth. Because if you think, this is the Gaussian curve of truth tellers, and this is the Gaussian curve of liars, and so therefore, almost none of the liars end up down here. I mean, if I extended this line way down here, it would be like 10 to the minus 7th or something. There are very, very few of them come down there. But the problem is the guys that are in here, and this is the ambiguous region. If I had a different color, I could. Yeah, it's a little bit, so I'm not, this is the ambiguous region in here. And anybody that's kind of in this area, we're not really sure. The ones who are more over here, we're thinking they're more liars, and the ones who are more over here, we're thinking they're more truth tellers. Now notice, these are very similar to those, except that there's more overlap. And you can get more overlap in two different ways. One, you can get more overlap by having the liars and the truth tellers, the mean of their distribution being closer together. And another way is by having more variability on these curves. But either way, so if this gets more spread out, there will be more overlap, or if these come closer together, there will be more overlap. But when there's more overlap, there are more people in here, in this region, where it's hard to tell the difference. And so what we're looking for is we're looking for methods what the statisticians call pictures that look like this, having better separation than pictures that look like that. And they'd like to move these humps as far apart as they possibly can, so that we can tell the liars from the truth tellers better. And when you saw those what they call rock curves, it's essentially the same thing. Okay? So you can take this picture here and you can translate it into one of those rock curves. There are different ways to draw the rock curves, whether the curve is out this way or down that way. If we're looking at false positives and false negatives, then a good result is something that's down in this corner where false positives are zero and false negatives are zero. It's way down here. So a curve that has better separation like that will look something like this, and a curve that has worse separation will look something like that, and flipping the coin will look like that. So this is random, and this curve would be right here, and this curve would be right here. So I'm just showing you different representations of the same problem, and what these curves lead to is that what I can do is I can, if I set my decision threshold different places, I can change false positives into false negatives, but I can't reduce both unless I change this picture to that picture, which means either having a better estimation method or better data collection. Now, the statistical pattern recognition cannot do anything if the pattern's not there to be recognized. And you guys are here to tell us what patterns can be recognized and can't be recognized, and what other data collection methods we might think of to get the right kind of data in order to do a better job of going from here to here. But if you give me a data set that has the pattern in there, I can do a lousy job of finding it if I use the wrong method. And so therefore, even with noisy data, I might be able to go from here to here, but I might not be able to go any further than this. And so what I'm looking for is how far can I go? And I'm also looking for how far can I go with some combination of people and machines, because people and machines are better at different things. In one article in tab 8, I guess it was my tab, they were talking about how there were certain features that they didn't use in their automated algorithm, even though they were good features in isolation for differentiating truth tellers from liars, and people might look at those features. And they said, but there are other features that we did use that were not helpful individually, but they were helpful in clusters, in groups. So one thing that machines can often do better than people is integrate combinations of features, whereas people, there's some psychological literature that suggests that people may go down through a list of features and say, okay, well, this feature says he's a liar, so I'm done, he's a liar. But if it doesn't tell me the answer, then I look at this feature. This feature says she's a truth teller, so she's a truth teller. But if it doesn't, then I go down to this feature. And that people are more better at single features processed in sequence. And computers can sometimes put features together in ways that people have difficulty doing. But on the other hand, we still can't duplicate people's recognition ability to do really complex recognition things that people are good at, such as recognizing faces or handwriting characters. Computers still aren't as good at that as people are. Okay. Let's see. I would say that the biggest innovation in statistical pattern recognition that has led to a lot of advances has been, from a Bayesian perspective, one way of putting it, is that we have biased our methods with very strong prior information, but not strong prior information in the way people used to think of priors. The strong prior information essentially says that in this data there's a pattern somewhere, there is a low-dimensional representation, but I'm not going to commit to exactly which low-dimensional representation it is. I'm not necessarily going to commit to which features it is. I'm not necessarily going to commit to how those features are combined, but it will be a simple rule with not very many parameters for combining them. And I don't know very much about the exact values of those parameters. I just know that I won't need very many features, and I won't need, and the features will be simple to calculate from the data, and from the raw data, and I'll be able to combine those features in a fairly simple way. And not only that, so that kind of prior information and the ability now with complex computers and with the theory that we have to juxtapose multiple models. So I don't know whether it's these three features or those three features, but it's not more than three features. So traditionally what you would do is you would pick one or the other and you would use it. And now what people are doing is they're saying, okay, well, I don't know whether it's these three features or those three features, so what I'll do is I'll keep both of them as possibilities and I'll average the models. And previously, if you had a six-feature model and that gave you 6 squared or 2 to the 6th or whatever, however your parameterization was, it gave you a lot of possibilities. Whereas now you can have these low-dimensional 2-3 feature models that are combined together more simply, and in a more robust way. After talking sort of in general about this pattern recognition issue, I want to go back to some issues in the particular papers that were in the tab that related to polygraph, in particular the Olson, Harris, and Capps paper, which describes in fair detail a computerized algorithm for evaluating polygraph data, which there they were doing supervised learning, and that's primarily applicable to single-issue polygraphing, because they had this data set, they had specific crimes, and they had a data set. They looked at, they went through this idea, they had the they went through a process of extracting features from the data, using those features in a statistical model, developing a statistical model that had a decision rule, which was logistic regression. It ended up with an output of a probability of deception, but then when they did their evaluation, they didn't use the probability of deception directly. They classified people as definitely lying, unknown, and definitely telling the truth, which was, I think, kind of interesting. They did an evaluation on their algorithm, and to their credit, they didn't just look at how well their algorithm performed on the data set. They did something that statisticians commonly do called a jackknife, which amounts to pretending that you haven't seen part of the data, estimating your model on part of the data, and trying to predict part of the model that you haven't seen. And you do it over and over again, leaving out different parts of the data. And so that gave them some kind of an assessment of how their method would perform on data sets that it hadn't seen.
I think the best question, the criterion there was the examiner's judgment, as I recall.
I'm getting down to that because I want to treat that is very true. Again, this was yes, no versus a fishing expedition, so it's not directly relevant to the panel's charge, and that's something that we have to look at. Is I think a key issue is if we were going to do an automated polygraph, what would we come out with on this? If you're using it for screening, what is the output of your statistical algorithm, and what is it that this polygrapher is coming out with in this case? What are you looking for? So that's something that was not treated in there. The other thing they did, and this seems to be very much commonly the case in everything that we've heard so far, is that they took this whole data set, and they lumped it all as a single data set, treating it as one homogeneous population. And they didn't look at any covariates, what kind of subject it is, what kind of examiner it is, what's their relationship, what was the severity of the crime, what was, I mean, there are lots of things, you know, the setting of the polygraph, what was the relevant base rate. There are a lot of issues that were, a lot of potential covariates that were not even considered that might be useful. And there's also this issue of what was the ground truth. They didn't even, actually, they just collapsed the data set on that, too. They didn't even, they didn't represent whether there was uncertainty. So they were just trying to reproduce the answer. And they said, well, the answer was that they were lying if they confessed, they were telling the truth if they were exonerated by independent evidence, and if we didn't have any independent evidence or any confession, then what we did was we had three polygraphers independently examining this data, the polygraph, and there was the original person who did the polygraph and two blind additional people, and if all three of them agreed, then we counted that as the right answer. And I guess they just threw everything else out once that they didn't have those agreements. And there is another issue, because then you're throwing out ambiguous cases, which means that, again, that you don't, that the population then is the cases that weren't ambiguous, the population in which you're estimating your model. It's not all of the polygraph results. And in fact, it's those ambiguous cases that are the ones that are really crucial there in the picture that I have. They're the ones that are in that overlap region, or in the picture in the top right-hand corner, they're very near that wiggly line. And again, they use the linear separation region, which is pretty much, it's very, very common in this kind of literature, but you can do better than that. But the other issue is that they did not speak in detail about how they chose their features. From reading the article and looking and reading between the lines, and having been a statistician for years, there are basically heuristics that good statisticians use to pick features, which if you're a good statistician, you don't overfit, you don't put too many features in, and you do some sensible procedure for weeding down the features to the ones that your model actually uses, but they didn't describe that in detail. The more recent statistical methods can actually include feature selection as part of the overall statistical model that gets estimated in kind of a stage-wise procedure. So then when they did their jackknife, I give them great credit for doing the jackknife, which is the technique where they hid part of the data. Actually, they just hid one observation, but that's good enough. You hide some of the data, you estimate the model on the rest of the data, and you try to predict the data that you hid, and you do this over and over again, and that gives you a statistical estimate of how good your procedure is on a data item that it hasn't seen. But what they didn't jackknife was the feature selection. So, and that's often the crucial part, right? And nobody jackknifes feature selection. And so the ability of jackknife to estimate error is limited by the fact that they didn't jackknife their feature selection, which, I mean, I can't complain too badly about that because nobody does it, but it is something that is very important and not done very well. And I guess that pretty much summarizes what I had to say about statistical pattern recognition as an approach to, I guess I wouldn't say just statistical pattern recognition, I would say methods from statistics and related disciplines for extracting patterns from data sets. And then I would say that there's also a lot of work at the interface between statistics and cognitive psychology and engineering on decision support and using quantitative models and computerized systems effectively in conjunction with human judgment that I think is relevant here. And because we have to recognize that we're not just throwing, even if we develop better automated algorithms that are better at classifying truth tellers from liars. We have to put that into we have to look at the system in which it's being used and how can it be used most effectively to augment the human judgmental process of deciding whether a person is a good security risk or not. Because that's the ultimate goal, is to figure out whether a person is a good security risk. And you can actually have a very good and statistically valid and reliable technique that if it's used in the wrong way organizationally can make your organization worse off than not using it at all. Can I do a very quick, also, I don't know, I'm probably running out of time, but I was going to do a quick illustration of values information, graphical illustration of that.
Let's hold that.
Okay.
You'll get lots of chances before we're done with that. Peter, did you want to just ask some other dimensions?
I have probably about 10 minutes of much less formal comments, given that it's 10:30, why don't we take a break?
That means that you want a break. I was going to enunciate a different committee rule for this morning, and that is no break except individual ones, which means people miss sporadically, but that way we won't have the reassembly problem, which seems to mean the breaks take much more than 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
So.
Let me add brief comments to Kathy, that close summary. And I'm going to direct my attention exclusively to the two papers, the logistic regression paper on automated summarization of the polygraph reading, and the paper by Joe Gasworth on predictive values and variability and predictive values. Some of what I'm going to say is primarily to underline Kathy's point, but the single point I want to make is that the emphasis of these papers is on how little we really know and how little the data give us. Okay. So to come back to the logistic regression paper, the automated data selection, the automated feature summarization with an index of prediction of probability of lying versus the truth, I want to agree with Kathy's remarks, but I go a little further. I want to point out that there are several ways in which you can overfit data, and overfitting is a problem with the kinds of techniques that they use. One way in which you can overfit data, Kathy has indicated, that is you can provide too complex, too large a class of functions to separate out your X's from your O's. Okay? Whether the functions are based on fractals, or whether they're based on straight lines, or whether they're based on polynomials, the point is that if you allow your functions to squiggle too idiosyncratically in relationship to the data, then when you try to use the same functions for the next set of data, you're likely to have substantial problems. And so if you expand your space of functions, however you do so, too greatly, then you have difficulty with overfitting. Now, another way of having difficulty with overfitting, however, that's quite different, it involves the class of features that you allow to be candidates for whatever model that you use for feature summarization. So in this paper, they have, in fact, used a very conventional and very simple model for feature summarization, that is a logistic regression model, which does require linearity on a scale. And in fact, to my mind, in that regard, is oversimple, because although it does allow for the detection of complexes of variables which in a linear way are interesting, whereas the individual components may not be interesting, it does not allow for the inclusion of interactive relationships between these variables on the scale, on the nonlinear scale, but with the linear predictor on which the logistic regression model is based. Okay, so the collection the collection of curves, in essence, is being drawn here. Does not allow you to say that the implications of feature A differ depending upon the value of features B, C, and D, or even simpler things than that.
But they could have.
Pardon? But they could have, absolutely. In fact, I would suspect that you would tell us that they...
So there are essentially no interaction terms?
There are no interaction terms in the model that they used.
But the model could have used interaction terms.
Absolutely. Yeah. They could have defined the model space in such a way as to incorporate interactions, and they could have done so within the context of the logistic regression model they used, or they could have done so in the context of any of the other possibilities that Kathy has indicated for nonlinear separation and for complex pattern recognition. But in this respect, they really limited their model space to a much simpler model than it would have been limited to by virtually any of the other methods that Nick Lang discussed, and certainly by the Kathy mentioned Bayesian models, which require or impose simplicity. And you can impose simplicity in terms of low-level parameterizations without excluding interactions. And so, really, this was a very substantial limitation of the paper. The model space was small. Now, on the other side of the coin, to my mind, they really opened the door to overfitting by the method of feature selection. And in essence, this is the applied physics laboratory, and I assume these people are vastly more computationally sophisticated and in-depth than I am. As Kathy remarked, they did not tell us how they selected their features. They did a lot of things right in this paper, many things right, in terms of most of the steps of data preparation. But when they went to select their features, what they do tell us is that they selected thousands of features and candidates for inclusion in their equation. Well, they selected thousands of features as candidates, but they only had a few hundred polygraph readings to discriminate. Okay? And as anybody who knows does logistic regression or any of these models, basically, the number of variables, the ratio of the number of variables to the number of subjects is a limiting factor on the degree to which you are likely to be able to generalize your results from the training data set to some new test data set. So they've taken thousands of variables here and they've summarized down to 10. And a procedure which does this, however they selected those 10 variables, whether they used rather classical stepwise methods or whatever manipulations they went through, any procedure which takes thousands of variables and reduces them to 10 variables in order to discriminate between a few hundred subjects, right, has a very high chance of producing a very accurate discriminator, even in the total absence of signal. In the total absence of signal. Okay. So in statistical terms, the type 1 error rate for this combination of procedures is enormous, right? And is totally underestimated by the conventional error rates that the computer programs produce.
And of course, they didn't jackknife the features.
Right. Now,
so this, in some sense, undermines the import of the jackknifing that they did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, I want to say something about the jackknifing too, as well. I mean, Kathy's absolutely, and Steve are absolutely right. They didn't jackknife the feature selection, and because of the inclusion of thousands of variables, the feature selection becomes potentially enormously sensitive to small variations in the data. Okay. Nevertheless, it's unlikely that the feature selection is very sensitive to an individual observation when the feature selection is chosen on the basis of hundreds of observations, any more than it is likely that the parameter values, and in particular the classification scheme that has been used here, in which the probabilities indicated are then classified into three levels, less than 10%, 10 to 90%, 10 to 90 to 100%, those are not likely to be very sensitive to the exclusion of one variable, of one subject either. So I question on heuristic grounds, and I have to go back and look at some of my jackknife and so on, but I question really whether the jackknife in these circumstances, even had they jackknifed feature selection, would have been an adequate way of indicating the true predictive validity of their algorithm on a new set of data. right? And that's something that I need to go back and look at. But I think that we can all agree at this point that the absence of feature selection, the huge numbers in the jackknife, the huge numbers of features used here, in fact, have imparted a false sense of security in terms of the reliability of the machine algorithm. Okay? And if any machine algorithm is constructed in such a way, and a critical issue here, to my mind, in this problem and other analogous problems in other sciences, is the complete absence of theory, as far as we can see, in the feature selection you're drawing. Okay? They have used totally data-driven guidelines to choose the number of features, choose the collection of features. We don't know how they've done it, and we really need theory to contribute to this kind of thing. Statistical manipulations and explorations can do lots of things, but what we can do infinitely more effectively if we have theory to guide us to reduce the space of possible parameterizations. At the same time, I think that if we had theory to guide us, then expanding the space of possible models with the kinds of simplicity expressions that Gabby was selecting, what it was suggesting, would probably lead to a much more productive, much more generalizable algorithm.
You can do that same thing with feature development and feature selection if you actually have some kind of a statistical model for, if you have a complexity parameter for your feature as a type of function of the raw data, and you put a prior based on that complexity, then you can actually do a Bayesian analysis of where you have a prior probability that a feature belongs in there, and then end up with a posterior probability. And that can, I've seen some very interesting papers on folding the feature development and selection process right in with the Bayesian analysis.
Do they actually indicate what the 10 features were?
No.
Yeah.
Well, we'll find out because we're going to get the program.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that this isn't the secret. It's just, and so there's interesting questions to pursue.
And we ought to try the program once again.
Yeah.
Day.
We were promised some data as early as next week, right?
I'll prefer a little more. You're trying to speak.
No, go ahead. No, I was going to make some comments.
Oh, okay.
Well, you did. It strikes me that there's a whole lot of other things going on here, too. When we were back here, we were all sort of agreeing that we knew how to do these. And the stuff in here is what sometimes gets called the margin, where we get to choose among curves. And Kathy was pointing out that as you add dimensions, clearly if you add enough dimensions, you can separate the X's and the O's. Okay, so think of our being able to do with a third dimension. So we are able to pull all the X's out over here. One of the interesting things is there's a lot of space over here, and it's empty. And one of the problems is with high enough dimensions, you can always do that. And so I can always make this space empty between the groups if there really is some potential separation. The difficulty is that there are other data. But maybe they don't have the labels, X's and O's. So, for example, we do have a lot of polygraph results, and they tell us something about these measurements, and they can fill up the space.
We don't know whether they're X's and O's.
Ah, but suppose when you plot them all, that the space is still separated. Then that tells you something about where the curves might sensibly go that you would draw. And that's where some of these newer unsupervised learning combined with supervised learning ideas come in. Is you actually ask something about the data without the labels, And you ask where they help fill up the space, and that's actually used to somehow help decide the allowable places to let your curves go. And it's not that linear is necessarily bad, because even I still believe in linear things, but there are things that you can do there, and it's sort of interesting. What I'm struck by, of course, is that none of this really tells us yet how to capture the heterogeneity that we keep worrying
about. Well, the heterogeneity,
unless
it's thought of
just a bunch of other variables.
It can be thought of as additional dimensions.
Yeah.
It can be thought of as, well, we have five different plots for five different subgroups, five different plots that look like that, but then if we make it a dimension, then we're layering five plots, and that gives us another dimension. So you can always think of the covariates as another dimension.
Now, what people do in the machine learning, data mining, statistical literature for this is not so much doing the jackknifing to get at the feature selection, but really splitting data into groups and doing full-scale cross-validation. Because predicting one is not quite right here, because you got to see what happens to the curve. This is too complex a thing to just predict one.
Not just to the curves, but to the whole feature selection
process. The whole process. And so the kind of arguments that people use, and that I teach the students in the class where I teach this kind of stuff, is if you have enough data, and that's a big question here, then you can divide the data into 10 groups, and you hold a big enough chunk out that you can do cross-validation to a group, and you really can't ask what happens in that setting.
They do these machine learning competitions every year where they have a data set, and you can download the data set, and you can put your best bidding, your best method. You can do whatever you want to this data set, and you submit your algorithm to them, and they run it on their whole sample, which they haven't told anybody about. And so, I don't know, maybe you could run a competition with polygraph data and see what people give you.
Well, and then part of the idea of this is that you don't have to just hold out one set. You can do this in groups in different combinations, and that's like the jackknife idea of cross-validation, but with groups. The groups really matter here, I think, is part of the world.
That's the more classic use of jackknife, as
right.
He described, and what they're calling jackknife here, I think of
it is the whole RMS version.
Something to call it, rather.
Yeah.
So basically, the single bullet point about this article and about other articles like it, and I should say that this point is by no means unique to this article or this literature, and it certainly could be applied to some of the work I've done in epidemiology, is that modeling of this sort without the kind of cross-validation or supplemental test sample that Kathy and Peter have talked about gives a much exaggerated impression of accuracy of the algorithms designed, the reproducibility of the algorithms described. And you have to go further than the initial data set. Now, the other article that hasn't been discussed yet, and I'll discuss very briefly, is Joe Gasler's article on the statistical precision of medical screening procedures, in which he focuses, going back to yesterday's discussion, on the predictive value, the particular positive predictive value of a positive polygraph test, or a positive test in any diagnostic situation. And again, the point of this article is how little we know. And so I want to describe the sort of baseline situation in which people talk about predictive values, and then I want to talk about Gasworth's and my expansion of that in terms of the way things need to be looked at. in medicine, where these predictive values are used all the time, and I know it's very, very important. The typical way that we do things is that we take the sensitivity and the specificity of a diagnostic test as reported by the manufacturers from some sample, and we take the estimated prevalence of a disease in some population, and we plug these into a formula, and we come out with a positive predictive value. Or we use cross-sectional data from some population and calculate the positive predictive value directly as the fraction of the results of the individuals who are positive on the test who actually turn out to have the disease in question, the correct diagnosis versus the test diagnosis. Okay. The point that Joe Gasperth brings out in particular is that the prevalence in the population, even if we know the population precisely we're talking about, that the prevalence figure that we use in that population is invariably an estimate from a data sample. That estimate carries variability, and that variability propagates through to the predictive value. So if the predictive value, in effect, although we use it as a number, is inevitably a range. And the range is to have great confidence in the predictive value, we have to widen the range. This point, by the way, applies also to the paper that Kathy and Steve and I were just discussing. Because, in fact, that paper produces a predicted probability of being in one group or the other for each individual in the training data set or potentially a new data set. But in fact, that predictive probability has an error range associated with it as well. And that error range could be estimated from the procedure that they've used, although the estimate that the procedure would generate, for the reasons we've discussed, would be a gross underestimate of variability, the true variability in the process. Okay. So the point is brought into sharper relief by Gasworth's study, in which he shows the extraordinary variation in positive predictive value, an estimated positive predictive value that one sees if one takes variability in the estimated prevalence in the population into account. But I would extend that point further and say that there are other sources of variation, in particular that sensitivity and specificity of the diagnostic test are themselves always estimates from samples that carry their own variability because typically these samples are too small. And so that if we looked at this whole thing, when we looked at the complexity of the whole system, and we looked at how the variability in these three different components of the predicted values propagates through to the summary indicator that we would have to use to diagnose in a polygraph situation or an analysis.